mornings. I'm Chris Oaks, and coming up today, Mayor Christina Mern joins us. We'll talk about the Findlay City Council meeting last evening that was packed with strong opinions on issues related to annexation, development, and housing. Also this morning, the more cryptocurrency becomes mainstream, the easier it is for scam artists to use it as a tool. And they are doing just that. We'll tell you what you need to know to protect yourself. And how's your completed books list coming along with summer read drawing to a close? We'll get an update on August programs and events at the Findlay-Hancock County Public Library. Sarah Clevidence will tell us what's happening. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Wednesday, July 22nd, 2026. This is important news. I mean, this is big stuff. A new survey reveals widespread fake productivity in U.S. workplaces. Out of 1,000 full-time professionals who were surveyed for this, 66% of employees, so two-thirds, and 73% of managers, three-quarters of all managers, admitted to faking productivity. Two-thirds of workers, three-quarters of managers. Gen Zers were the most guilty. 80% confessed that they have faked productivity in the workplace. Finance sector workers topped industry rankings. 85% of financial industry workers, finance sector workers, have faked productivity. The average worker, the story goes on to say, spends 5 hours a week maintaining the appearance of busyness without actually doing anything. That is nearly 7 work weeks a year. 7 work weeks out of the year, we're not doing anything. Common tactics include moving the computer mice and jiggling the computer mice, and I know that was big during the pandemic when people were working remotely and workplaces were tracking how much the computers were being used to make sure that people were working. The people were jiggling the mice to keep their computers active. Keeping decoy browser tabs open, so it looks like you've got a lot of things going on. Deliberately delaying message responses. Because if you respond too quickly, it means you're not doing anything. If it takes you a while to get back to someone, they think you're busy doing all of these things. So deliberately delaying message responses. Experts say that it's not laziness, and that's the key here in this story. It is not laziness. That may be the first thing that people think, oh, it's people being lazy. No. They say burnout and micromanagement from above drive this behavior. Many employees, the researchers say, are not avoiding work. They are just responding to workplace cultures that still reward visibility as much as results. Looking busy rather than actually being busy. And if that describes you, I'm sorry for blowing the lid off of it for you. Ruining the little thing you got going there at work. But it's kind of interesting to know. And I thought what I thought was really interesting, not just two-thirds of workers, but three-quarters of managers admit to having done this. So. Some of the other most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Wednesday morning started. This is interesting medical news. New research shows an antidepressant medication may help those struggling with long COVID. I know it's been a long time since we've, really talked about COVID as being a thing, but there are those who, long after recovering from the virus itself, deal with the after effects of COVID. They call it long COVID, and a joint study involving researchers from Canada, Brazil, and McMaster University, and I'm not sure where McMaster University is, but anyway, these researchers looked at 400 adults experiencing fatigue from long COVID. And they found that fluvoxamine, it's an antidepressant medication, significantly reduced fatigue and improved quality of life in those who are dealing with the effects of long COVID. One of the study's authors says it is an important step forward for patients who have been desperate for, you know, options that actually work, evidence-based solutions to what they've been dealing with now for, in some cases, many, many years. It is estimated up to 400 million people are impacted by long COVID worldwide. So this could mean that there is help. And that is certainly good news. Kind of an interesting legal case that I saw here on the Newswire. A retired attorney in New York, John Bonamy Jr. is his name, is suing his mortgage lender, in this case, J.P. Morgan Chase. He wants to void his $3.85 million mortgage. He wants to just void it. Void his mortgage. He claims that he was experiencing a manic episode when he purchased a home in Cape Cod back in November of 2021. Because you see, the mansion, nearly 6,000 square foot mansion, actually sat on the edge of an eroding cliff. A cliff that was losing anywhere between 3 to 6 feet annually. It was just eroding. It was just falling away. And the mansion was sitting there on the edge of the cliff that is eroding away. So you know what's going to happen here. The house had to be demolished in March of 2025. And while he had a $3.85 million mortgage, I don't know what he paid for it, he had a mortgage that was the better part of $4 million. After the home itself was demolished, the property's land was reassessed at just $385,000. So that is, what, 1/1000th of the of the value of the mortgage. So he wants the bank to void his mortgage. He argues, and he's taking this to court, he argues that no rational person would have considered purchasing the property. And he points out that he has previously been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. He was having a manic episode when he agreed to buy the property and the bank lent him the money. Legal experts say Mr. Bonamy faces a difficult burden of proof, to say the least. J.P. Morgan Chase denied the allegations and wanted to throw out the case, but the judge would not do that. So apparently it's headed to a jury trial now. No rational person would buy this. I mean, what was the bank supposed to do? He met all the qualifications. I don't know how the property appraised for whatever it took to get that loan when the cliff is falling away. But you know, anyway, it'd be interesting to see how that. By the way, speaking of interesting legal challenges, this is another story that I happen to see. The Supreme Court has agreed to take up a case out of Alaska where a pilot is challenging the state's bid to seize his plane. He's a private pilot. He has a 1969 Cessna, and he operates it like sort of an air taxi, like an air Uber, to transport people here and there around Alaska's wilderness. Well, the state of Alaska is looking to seize his plane because a passenger tried to fly into a village that is dry and no alcohol, and he was carrying a 6-pack of Budweiser into this dry village. And this guy, Ken Jopi, I think is how you pronounce it, was flying him into this dry village with a 6-pack of Budweiser. He says he had no idea that the guy had any alcohol with him. And he says losing his plane is an excessive fine in violation of the Eighth Amendment, which is the one that guarantees no cruel and unusual punishment or excessive fines in the criminal justice system. That's the Eighth Amendment. And that does seem a little excessive. I mean, the guy was taken, a guy that he didn't know and didn't know that he was carrying alcohol, was flying a six-pack into a dry village, and the state wants to seize his plane. That does seem a little excessive. Alaska's top court upheld the forfeiture, so he is now taking it to the Supreme Court. Wow. That does seem to be extreme. Crazy. Don't take booze into a dry village in Alaska, I guess, is the message there. It's crazy. I want to know, what about the guy who took the beer or tried to take the beer into the village? What's his... I mean, did he get the death penalty or something? I mean, you know, that... what was his penalty? Almost did. And this is kind of interesting. Lastly here, among the first things that you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. When was the last time you saw a manual transmission, a vehicle with a manual transmission up for sale on a dealership lot? They have nearly vanished from American roads. Federal data show that stick shifts made up just 0.6% of all of the vehicles on the market in the U.S. for the 2025 model year. Just 0.6%. In 1980, it was like 35%. Experts cite faster shifting automatic technology as a key driver, but also all of the safety features that won't work unless you have an automatic clutch and automatic transmission. There are a lot of safety features that just don't work on manual transmission vehicles. Let's see here. Rising SUV popularity, along with the growth of electric and semi-autonomous vehicles, have also accelerated the decline. Major automakers are pulling back. There are zero manual transmissions across the entire model line for Subaru, Honda, BMW, Volkswagen, and Toyota. No manual transmissions offered. Remember when you have to pay extra for an automatic? And now they don't even offer. Automatic is standard. Only about 24 production vehicles still offer the option, but one of the main notable holdouts, the Ford Mustang. Ford CEO Jim Farley vows that you will have to pry the manual Mustang out of our cold, dead hands. So if you were worried, don't worry. The manual transmission Mustang, stick shift Mustang, ain't going anywhere. I just thought that was at 0.6%. Wow. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Wednesday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather. Partly to mostly sunny today with a high in the 70s. Mostly clear tonight, low in the 50s. The Wood County Sheriff's Office says a 17-year-old who was reported missing in June has returned home. In June, the Sheriff's Office requested the public's assistance in locating 17-year-old Gavin Lee, who was last seen on June 3rd when he left his home in Jerry City to go camping. Since then, many people have been looking for Gavin and sharing potential sightings with the Sheriff's Office. The Wood County Sheriff's Office says Gavin returned home on Tuesday with no injuries and appeared to be healthy with no immediate concerns for his health or well-being. The Sheriff's Office thanks the community for their help in searching for Gavin and also other law enforcement jurisdictions that helped in sifting through the numerous tips and leads that were received. While kratom is illegal in Ohio, the law is not preventing dangerous consumption by Ohio youth, with nearly 2,000 exposure cases reported last year.
It's called 7-Hydroxy and is sold as 7-O or kratom in gas stations all over the country. Here in Ohio, Governor Mike DeWine successfully pushed to ban kratom-related compounds. Now, health experts are warning of the drug's extremely addictive property.
I see a lot of 7-OH in my own clinic, a lot of young people who have started to use it. And because 7-OH has these opioid properties, they come into me and they're actually experiencing, in many cases, symptoms of opioid addiction.
ONN's Colin Dorsey with Dr. Scott Hadland. The Ohio Department of Transportation is letting drivers know of a road closure in Hancock County. ODOT says U.S. 224, just east of County Road 23, near the Seneca County line, will be closed this week for drainage work and a culvert replacement. A detour is posted. Get more on this project and other road construction projects in the area in this story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news online anytime at WFIN.com.
Findlay City Council's meeting last evening, the key item on the agenda was the third reading, the ordinance which finally settled the long simmering issue with respect to the Casto development. This is the housing project, the north end of Findlay off County Road 99, near the new diverging diamond interchange. This has been talked about and discussed for many months, and Mayor Christina Murn is with us this morning. Obviously, last night during the discussion on this third reading, when City Council has to give that final up or down vote, there's a lot of spirited discussion with respect to this project. Talk a little bit about, just for the purposes of background, first of all, kind of the history of this, because as we mentioned, this has been kind of an ongoing thing for, several months now?
Yeah, so this has been a project that I've kind of been working on, trying to pull together for actually many years. So when we look at the southwest corner of 99 and 75, mm-hmm. the areas that we need to put utilities for that really to be developed, so the roadways, the sanitary sewer, the storm sewer, the water lines, for some of the parcels that are ready to develop, but the infrastructure needs to go on neighboring properties. And so what we've been working to pull together is kind of a master plan for the infrastructure in that area. And I think council was totally on board with that aspect.
Right.
One thing that made it a little more confusing is that the one developer had to buy more land than they needed for their project, and it happened to be land that the city had previously expressed interest in along 75 for a future pedestrian bridge, for detention for the surrounding properties to make them more developable, because that land has limited developable ability because of some wetlands and just the overall mm-hmm. drainage in that area. And so we got through a deal with Casto where the city would purchase the land from them, and then Casto would pay us back for the land over time. So that was originally, I had introduced it where the city would take out debt and pay for it over time and then be reimbursed by Casto over time. Council instead said they wanted to pay cash for it and then be paid back over time rather than doing a debt issuance. And so that is what the deal is. It is approving, entering into a development agreement, which helps reimburse the city both for the infrastructure costs as well as for the land.
Yeah.
And though our total cost on the infrastructure side won't be recouped immediately, last at the end of, 2024, I believe, we had actually implemented a TIF district on those parcels in anticipation of doing this. So now, as those surrounding parcels are developed, the city will then also receive additional revenues to offset the infrastructure costs and any other infrastructure that is identified as those parcels are built out. So I think it was really, I thought it was good discussion. I know some council members weren't as involved in the conversation over the last 6 months, and so they had, more questions, but ultimately I think we got to the right decision. And I think that we're going to see the fruits of that investment over the next couple of months.
Well, as you mentioned, it was that that parcel of property that seemed to be the biggest sticking point and where the most questions arose. As you mentioned, it seemed like there was a pretty universal agreement that, yes, we need to extend city services and in order to develop that property maybe that was a necessity and so on. Talk a little bit about more about what that property is good for and why the city has an interest in getting that particular piece of property that is, you know, by your own admission, undevelopable.
Well, to be clear, it's not developable for significant structures. You're not going to want to put a business or a house there. It is prime for infrastructure and is able to be developed in that way. So it allows us to run paths or roadways to other neighboring properties. It allows us to, if we so desire in the future, something we've been talking about for a while is a pedestrian bridge to connect the Cube Recreation Complex to the west, into those neighborhoods, into these other developments, into the hotel. That then makes the property to the north of the parcel more developable and more desirable because it has connectivity and utility access. And then we also can look at putting some of the detention and stormwater runoff needs onto that parcel because it's already built, you know, to handle that because the water drains that direction. And that then allows the neighboring properties to be more developable. And then that in turn increases the overall property value, which then in turn is the revenue coming back to the city.
So again, in your mind, there's really no benefit to not having this property. In other words, this is not something that you are taking out of potential development for someone else. Not only does the current owner not necessarily need it, no one else would want it for a similar purpose.
Correct. It really is. And, you know, I think the other thing to consider is because we need it for some of our future, you know, desires in that area, then later, if we weren't doing it a part of this deal where there's kind of accountability and benefit to everyone, then the price could go up, right? The price of nothing's going down at the moment. Right. And so I think we got it $10,000 below the appraised value of those parts of those specific parcels and per acre, and $20,000 below appraisal for what the developer purchased it, or $20,000 per acre below what the developer paid for it, and closer to, you know, $20,000 or $30,000 below what some of the other parcels in that area have gone for. So I understand that it's very complex and convoluted, but I think that ultimately in the very near future, we will hopefully be able to announce some other great projects coming to that area. And hopefully folks will see the bigger picture. I know it's always nice to have all of the certainty and be able to roll it out at one time, but that's not always the case when you're working on complex projects like this.
That was not the only topic of housing that was brought up. A little bit later on in the meeting, there was some public input with some additional concerns, and I know we've talked about this in the past. There are concerns with respect to the Shady Grove redevelopment, and concerns being expressed by a number of individuals about additional concessions being made to Vision Properties in order to redevelop that parcel for multifamily housing. It does seem as though there, every time we turn around, there are additional concessions that are being asked for, additional benefits being asked for the city. Now, I know this is not something that was actually on the agenda, but there was some public input on this. What are your thoughts with respect to where that is right now? And should the city be making even further commitments and concessions to those developers for that property?
Well, I guess I would clarify. I don't see them as concessions. I see them as working with developers and trying to be reasonable, just as we evaluate when, you know, other properties or businesses within our community identify challenges with our code. So, you know, when we're looking at the Vision Development Project or Vision Companies Project, They requested two variances, and both were appropriate. One was a slightly smaller footprint on one of their kind of studio apartment layouts, mm-hmm. which I think made sense. It's, you know, we have many people that come and stay in our communities and are spending at extended stay hotels that would be interested in having a nicer apartment or you know, think better options for when they're here during the week. And then the other was decreasing and the number of parking spots. We're evaluating our parking standards because in certain districts, our parking standards are out of date. And so that's something that we need to have a larger conversation about. So I think they were both appropriate. And that is certainly how the board voted. When we look at tax abatements, you know, I think I understand the feeling that, hey, we're giving something up. Mm-hmm. But the reality is when banks are looking at financing projects like this, pretty much these projects don't pencil out from a financing standpoint right now to without the abatements. And it's happening across the state, happening across the country where, you know, one, we're competing for investment. And so we need to make sure that we are being considered. And again, we don't need to say yes to every project, but these have been good projects from reputable companies and good products that they're providing. And the reality is that Shady Grove is not going to be operational. Mm-hmm. They're stopped. They're in business. They're paying only $7,000 a year in property taxes. And this development is going to bring in significantly more tax revenue to the schools and to the community as a whole, even with the abatement, even within the abatement period, significantly more, hundreds of thousands of dollars more in property taxes a year for all of the impacted entities. And so, you know, this is getting more attention because it is an individual approval, where our prior CRA, if they had filed under our pre-94 CRA, mm-hmm. it would have just happened. And so I think that it is good that we're transitioning to this and having the discussion around it. But I think folks need to understand that this is not uncommon. This is not unusual. And I think is really beneficial to the community long term. And so I don't see them as concessions. I see them as being good to work with and evaluating our policies and making sure that we're working with businesses that we want to have in the community.
So it... The last time we had you on, we were talking about this. We mentioned the Shady Grove development, the Casto development. There's another development of housing that is being discussed as well. And, you know, so we've got these like three big projects that are kind of in the works right now. And you had mentioned before that you felt that this was where we needed to be with respect to these types of development, that we'd not be looking at additional ones moving forward. You still feel that way?
I think we're going to always evaluate projects as they come in. We can't just say, no, we're not talking,
right.
You know, we're not talking to any more developers of multifamily or things like that. But I do think that this is meeting the current market demand. And so once we get these projects kind of moving forward and under construction, my focus is going to continue to be, how do we support single family residential housing? Because, you know, it is always complex. In making sure that we have appropriate market mix and price points, and single family residential housing does not qualify for the same types of abatements that are as you know, able to do. So we're going to be looking at infrastructure support. There are options with residential TIF districts. There's a lot of different tools that we still have that we have historically not used. And so I'm trying to learn more about that and put more pieces of the puzzle together so we can get more single family residential and other products. But I do think that looking at the market demand, I think we're going to be good for a little while in that, in the multifamily condos, villas, and this product. Yeah.
We will leave it there for now. A lot of discussion with respect to housing and annexation and incentives to developers, development overall that continues to drive the conversation. And Findlay Mayor Christina Mern, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Thanks, Chris. Have a good rest of your day.
Well, the more cryptocurrency becomes mainstream, the easier it is for scam artists to use it as a tool. And that is exactly what they are doing. We are joined this morning by Lane Monsey, is president of the Better Business Bureau of Northwest Ohio and Southeast Michigan. And you recently put out an alert on this. And I guess when you think about it, it makes sense that cryptocurrency has become mainstream enough to seem legitimate and to be relatively easily accessible, and yet it is still unregulated enough that it allows scammers to take off with these funds. They're untraceable and really unrecoverable in most cases. So this is kind of a sweet spot for scam artists.
Yeah, we did feel it's important enough, and because there's a little bit of a new twist on cryptocurrency. So cryptocurrency scams have been around since cryptocurrency came out.
Sure.
Simply because you really can't trace or track crypto funds. Once you part with them, if you part with them to a scammer, they're gone. You're not getting them back. Mm-hmm. But the reason we wanted to put out the alert is there is a new growing trend, and you talk about crypto going mainstream. What's more mainstream than having your own ATM in handy locations?
Yeah.
There are crypto ATMs, and I searched for them by state and county, and Findlay has one. Lucas County has about 8. The machines themselves are not illegal, nor are they a scam.
Mm-hmm.
But scammers have figured out how to use those
right
to pressure people. So instead of asking for payment for services or to settle a dispute or to get out of an arrest warrant, they're calling people up and they're saying they can pay by crypto, and that expedites the process. That is one type of crypto scam. People actually go to these machines, put in cash, and you can put it into your crypto account, or you can immediately have it put into someone else's crypto account. That's
there
the secret,
you go.
And you're never going to be able to track it or get it back.
And in fact, you cite a case in Lima of a consumer that lost literally thousands, I think it was $17,000 at one of these scams.
Yes.
And it's interesting to hear you describe the most common ways this kind of manifests itself. The actual underlying scams, those are not new. Those are things that we've heard warnings about in the past.
Yeah. So this might arise from, for instance, a romance scam where somebody needs money, but it can arise from resolving disputes. It can be government impersonators saying you owe this tax or you owe this fine. And so any way that a scam can come up where they might ask for gift cards, they can ask for crypto.
And again, because this is more legitimate now, I mean, you use the example of a supposed government agency or law enforcement agency says that you have to pay this fine or something like that. I think we're all conditioned now to say, well, you know, the government's not going to accept payments of fines in Amazon gift cards or Apple gift cards or something like that. This, again, crypto does add that little bit of quote unquote legitimacy to it. It is plausible, I think, in the minds of many that this could be legitimate because it's not, you know, the gift card thing that we've kind of trained our brain to be the trigger in identifying the scam. So again, it goes back to understanding the underlying urgency here. That's the scam, regardless of how you're being asked to pay.
You know what it reminds me of, Chris, and I like to think of it this way because I think there's a good parallel. When you watch movies about diseases or plagues or outbreaks or apocalypse, and they say, oh, the virus is evolving, right? Every time we try to fix part of it, it evolves. And we know that, you know, like bacteria can be resistant to the penicillins and other medicines because it evolves. And that is the same thing that happens with scams. A scam emerges. We learn how to warn people about it. People get wise to it. That scam becomes less effective, and then they evolve and they pivot to a different way to do it. It's going to be a never-ending process in our lifetime.
The one big thing that is common to all of these scams, we've talked about this before, and this should be the biggest red flag, is that level of urgency, that element of urgency that you have to act right away, that should be a dead giveaway that something is not on the up and up if they want you to act before you've had a chance to really think about it.
Absolutely. Because urgency gets us into our emotional state and out of our rational state. Mm-hmm. But the other one is unsolicited. A friend appears to contact you on Facebook Messenger out of the blue. You get a text out of the blue. Someone calls you. The government contacts you about something you'd never heard before. Mm-hmm. Law enforcement contacts you about a warrant. What? I don't have any warrants.
Yeah.
Well, they'll make it seem like you do. So it's that unsolicited coupled with urgency that is really the poison pill that can catch any of us in a moment of weakness in our busy lives.
Yeah, you just can never let your guard down. So here's the next question then. If we do think that maybe we have become the victim of one of these cryptocurrency scams, as we mentioned, the reason why scammers like it is because it is generally untraceable and unrecoverable. So what do we do?
Well, if you've parted with the money, you probably need to write that off, and then you need to put away your shame and disappointment in yourself, because that doesn't mean you're dumb. It means you're human, because they're very effective and very good at these scams.
Right.
The first thing is realize that you're not getting what you parted with. Number two, cut off all contact. If you've given anybody usernames and passwords, if you connected anything to your bank account, immediately contact your bank and disconnect that credit card number to any account you might be funding. Don't send any more money. Don't go down the rabbit hole of them saying, well, if you just pay this extra fee or you prepaid the taxes, you will get your money, or you need to pay for insurance. No, that's just part of the scam. Pay not one penny more. Do not pay one penny more. Step away from the ATM machine. Disconnect contact. You can report it to the FTC. You can report it to attorney generals in your state. You can report it to the police. You can report it to the BBB, and you should do all those things, but you're probably not going to get the money back. So the first thing I would recommend is don't engage. Don't get emotional. Sever all the contacts that you made so that they can't get any more money out of you.
You have a scam tracker where folks can learn all of the latest details on these scams that are going around. I know that's why you encourage people to contact the BBB if they've been a victim, so that you can give others the heads up. Where do folks find that information?
Scamtracker.org. And Scam Tracker is part of the BBB, but it is also really administered by our companion charity, the Institute for Marketplace Trust. It's sort of their signature marquee program. Not only can you find out about scams, you can report. And I have to say, we can't stop it all, but we can enlist an army of citizens, like in your listeners right now, and they can join in. And that's really probably the best way to keep the warnings current.
Again, Lane Montz is president, CEO of the Better Business Bureau of Northwest Ohio and Southeast Michigan, talking about all of the latest cryptocurrency scams that are making the rounds, and they are definitely out there. We've got examples that we were citing that people have been victimized, so we're not talking in the abstract here. Lane, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Chris, thanks for helping us get the word out.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
Sometimes you don't have to go very far to find the broken news. Charges are being filed against two guests at the Cedar Point Amusement Park in Sandusky, who police say refused to exit a ride last week. Now, I know we've all been there. You go to Cedar Point and you get on one of those fabulous rides, maybe Millennium Force or, the Maverick or, Siren's Curse, the new one, one of the, great Top Thrill. Would love to go again. You want to go again and again. Do I really have to get off? Well, this was none of those. According to the report, two people from Philadelphia were on the Sky Ride on Wednesday evening and refused to get off when the ride came to an end. Of all of the rides to refuse to get off, the Sky Ride. In addition to their refusal to exit the ride, security officers told police that the guests were carrying an unapproved container of food. No food on the Sky Ride! An unapproved container of food. The whole incident brought the ride to a screeching halt, stranding other guests high above the midway in 90-degree temperatures. The riders were eventually dragged off the property. They were charged. By the way, the riders in question, ages 66 and 72. These were teenagers. 66-year-old and a 72-year-old. The charges include disorderly conduct and obstructing official business for allegedly giving police officers fake names. All over a refusal to exit the sky ride, of all things. Okay. Elsewhere in the broken news, this is not going to do anything to improve the reputation of Kentucky. There is a new law that is now in effect in Kentucky, which aims to enhance safety measures for organ donation. The law went into effect last week, now requires that the organ procurement procedure be paused if any signs of life are observed in the donor. Which does seem reasonable. You know what I mean? You want to make sure that the person donating the organ is done using it. That does seem reasonable. And like most strange laws that are on the books, there's a reason why they had to pass this law. The legislation was prompted by an incident back in 2021 where an organ donor was found to be alive on the operating table, leading to the procedure's cancellation, thank goodness, and an investigation by the state attorney general's office. I don't know. Do you really need a law? You would hope that most doctors, if they discovered that an organ donor was still alive, would stop the procedure. You would think that you wouldn't need a law to clarify that, but apparently in Kentucky, they do. And lastly, here in the broken news this morning, a Lakeland, Florida man with an extensive criminal history has been charged again following a theft at a local Walgreens store. 47-year-old Gerald Cobbs, who so far carries 27 felony and 17 misdemeanor convictions, mostly theft-related, and has served over 11 years in prison. He was identified through surveillance footage after three suspects stole nearly $650 worth of body wash last month from the Walgreens. $650 worth of body wash. Apparently, this is a three-person job. Two accomplices distracted store clerks while the others filled the bags with merchandise before leaving without paying. Mr. Cobbs was already actually jailed on a separate warrant, and now he faces additional charges. Go big or go home, I guess. There you go. That is today's Broken News Report. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
WFIN needs your help to stuff the bus with school supplies for needy students in our area. Go to WFIN.com for donation information. Bring your donation to the Yellow School Bus at the Tiffin Avenue McDonald's in Findlay, Thursday and Friday, July 23rd and 24th from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. School supply registration forms are required and can be accessed at cchsupport.org. Stuff the Bus brought to you by McDonald's, Flag City Auto Wash, Tidy Rides, Family Resource Center, and 1330 WFIN.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. This is the age-old debate, whether this generation has it harder than the previous generation. And I think, you know, every generation thinks they've got it harder. But in this case, it appears that something we all agree, or most of us agree on. This new survey finds that growing majorities of Americans do believe that young adults face steeper financial challenges today than their parents' generation. The sharpest shift involves job hunting, which I thought was kind of interesting. 64% now say that it's harder for young people to find work than it was in previous generations. That is up from 39% who felt that way in 2021. So just in the course of 5 years, a substantial increase in the number of people believe that it's harder for young people to find a job these days. Home ownership concerns rose sharply as well. This is what I thought would be right at the top of the list. People think it's harder for young people to buy their first home than it used to be, because we've seen just how sharply home prices have risen in the past 5 years or so. But 87% say it's harder today for young adults to become homeowners compared to their parents' generation. 5 years ago, that was 70%. So a really high number, but the jump over the course of the past 5 years is not as big as job hunters. So kind of interesting. 8 in 10 Americans say that covering basic expenses is harder for today's young adults. Only 6% say it's easier. And again, I think we've seen what has happened with just everyday expenses, regular prices of everyday stuff, and the way it's gone up in the past 5 years. Not a surprise that 8 in 10 Americans say that covering basic expenses is harder for young adults today. Younger respondents felt the burden most acutely. Not a surprise. 75% of adults between the ages of 18 to 29 cited finding a job as harder than it was for their parents. So you might ask the question, and this is the next logical extension of this, how many young adults have actually reached all of those milestones? You're talking about finding a job, buying a home, and being able to meet your daily expenses. That's kind of the three-legged stool of financial independence. Well, relatively few young adults have actually reached all three of those milestones. Only 25% of the 21-year-olds in the survey were financially independent in 2021. And I would imagine that that's even lower now, but that was in 2021, only 25%. In 1980, the number of 21-year-olds that were financially independent based on those metrics was 42%. Time to get an update on what's happening as we come up on the month of August already. The Findlay Hancock County Public Library and Sarah Clevidence is with us. First of all, Summer Read drawing to a close. What this week is pretty much it for Summer Read, right?
Saturday is the last day of Summer Read, but there is still a couple of great programs this week.
Okay.
If you haven't had enough dinosaurs yet. T-Rex Storytime is tomorrow morning at 9:30. On Friday afternoon, that will be Tween Science Day, all about geodes. So still some great opportunities there to explore the dinosaur theme. And then Saturday, we're having our 1,000 books celebration. So this is an opportunity to celebrate all of those amazing kiddos who have either read 1,000 books before starting kindergarten or are in progress, or even families who just want to learn more about the program. Be a party with a story, a ceremony, a craft, and a bubble dance party at the end.
Going to be an awful lot of fun. So if you're still working on, you know, getting your total up there for your Summer Read final tally, only have a few days left to get that done. And obviously, as we mentioned, there are prizes involved and all of that. So a lot of incentive for kids to get that reading in the final few days of Summer Read. Want to look ahead a little bit to this year's Author Fest. I know you have just opened it up to encourage more authors to sign up for this. Tell us more, first of all, about what Author Fest is for those who may not know, and how authors can sign up for this.
Yeah, so this year will be our 11th annual local author fair, Author Fest. We hold it during the fall art walk, so it'll be November 6th this year in the evening. So authors are welcome to come set up a table, have their books available for sale. We really are trying to spotlight Northwest Ohio authors, but any author who's willing to come is welcome. Mm-hmm. There are applications currently being accepted for authors until October 1st. And we're really just kind of limited by how many authors we can squeeze in to the space we have available at the library. It is always just a really wonderful experience to see all of these local authors mm-hmm. Engaging with our community, talking about their work, how they work through the writing process, and seeing the authors get to know each other as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine is an awful lot of fun. I'm sure that folks will meet individuals, fellow writers they've not met before that are, you know, right in their own backyard, basically. As you mm-hmm. mentioned, you like to focus on Northwest Ohio, obviously, and primarily most of the authors are from our immediate region, but you do have others from around Ohio and even beyond that have come in the past. So,
yes, over the years, we've had some farther flung authors who have come. And, you know, it's always interesting to see the wide variety of genres those yeah. authors are representing. We've had folks with children's books, fiction, nonfiction, chapter books, picture books, wide variety of adult fiction, nonfiction again, memoirs, self-help, history,
yeah,
romance, short stories, fantasy, sci-fi. It's
yeah,
really diverse.
And it's really cool to see the number of authors. I think a lot of times people are surprised just how many great authors and aspiring authors there are in our own region.
Absolutely. We usually have between 20 and 30 authors
yeah.
there.
Yeah. So circle that on the calendar. But again, if you are an author or you know an author, this is a great opportunity to kind of get your name out there. And if folks want to learn more about signing up for AuthorFest, all of that is on the website, right?
Absolutely. FinleyLibrary.org.
All right. Very good. So put that out there. And what else is going on as we come up on the month of August here?
Hard to believe that it's almost August. Summer yeah. is really winding down. So we'll have a new series called Finance Fridays for adults starting in August. It'll be August 14th, 21st, and 28th. These are all going to be taking place virtually on Zoom.
Okay.
James Powell from Edward Jones will dive into a different financial topic each week from noon to one on those Financial Fridays series. So that should be a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
I am really excited about one of the creative ideas our staff came up with. We're having an Excel 101 book tracker class. So okay. if you want to know a little bit about Excel and you want to come up with a better way to keep track of what you read,
mm-hmm.
this is the class for you. This okay. should be very interesting.
Okay. And when is that?
That one is Monday, August 24th.
Okay. All right.
And then right on its heels, Puzzle Race makes its return. That's a very popular one with our patrons. So I know our puzzle enthusiasts are ready to register. That registration opens on August 1st. We are limited to 7 teams that will be racing to complete a 500-piece puzzle.
That sounds like
Puzzle Race again takes place on the 27th. Registration for that opens on August 1st.
Okay. Terrific stuff. And obviously, you've got programs for all ages. Anybody, obviously, a lot of programs for youth, teens, and adults at the library. What else you want to highlight here coming up in the month of August as we start to think about back to school?
Yes, we do. Well, our youth services team will be taking a little bit of a break in August as they recover from summer read,
mm-hmm.
but we still will have our mini meetups on Wednesdays and Fridays in August. So those are from 9 to 11. Those are a great opportunity for kids and young children and their parents to come, explore the games and toys and activities at the library and also meet other families while they do so.
Okay. All right. So check those out. Again, more details on all of the programs are there on the website. And if folks are looking for a title to add to their late summer reading list, you have a couple of new titles that are coming out in the coming weeks that will be released in the coming weeks. What are we looking at here?
I do. And all of these are kind of giving me fall vibes. The first one's a horror novel called The Unknown, and horror always makes me think fall and Halloween. So this one is about Marion Keene, who is a struggling actress, thrilled to be cast as the main character in a famous director's newest movie. She travels with her co-stars to an island in Vermont to study the roles. This movie is based on the diary of a woman who disappeared alongside four other women on that same island in 1926. Slowly, terror unfolds as the actresses begin to experience the same fates as their characters.
Hmm.
That one publishes on August 4th.
Okay.
Also on August 4th, I think the very opposite sort of book is an inspirational romance by Kathleen Fuller called Autumn at the Cat Cafe. So this is, if you like grumpy sunshine romances, cats, and all the small town fall vibes, this one might be for you.
Okay.
It's set in Pecan Corner, Ohio, which is the home of Positive Vibes, a cat cafe owned by Via. Via is shocked when the owner of the bookstore next door passes away. It's her intent to purchase and preserve this second chapter books. But then the handsome heir arrives to assume ownership. Leo, of course, wants to sell the shop and return to LA as soon as possible. Via challenges him to complete her autumn bucket list, hoping to prove the value of both the bookstore and show him the fun involved in small town fall. So that one publishes also on August 4th.
Terrific
stuff. And then for fans of Leanne Moriarty, you may be familiar with Big Little Lies that she published 10 right. years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Her sequel, Big Little Truth, is coming out August 25th.
Okay.
So with their children now in high school, Madeline, Celeste, and Jane are braving the challenges of the teenage years. It seems they have even more to contend with when the high school principal receives a disturbing package and a stranger begins to ask seemingly innocent questions. This one's sure to be another character-driven suspense about the dark side of suburban life. So like I said, this one publishes August 25th. Holds lists are available for all of these. You could also put Big Little Lies, both the book and the HBO series, on hold at the library as well if you want to catch up on that before reading the new one. Okay.
Good stuff there. And Sarah Clevidence with us from the Findlay Hancock County Public Library. Lots of things going on as we head into the month of August. And we've got a link on our webpage for more information about all of it. Sarah, thanks very much for taking the time. As always, we appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. Thanks again to all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. And remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the program at our webpage. Visit us online at goodmornings.net. Also, if you're a regular listener to the podcast, we would appreciate it very much if you would take a moment or two to leave us a rating or review on your favorite podcasting platform to help others discover the show as well. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.